Hello and welcome to Life's Rosie, the podcast that will hold your hand through your breakup recovery, take you from rock bottom to reinvention and help you survive and then thrive. Today, I feel honoured to be joined by a journalist and editor who I've always greatly admired. Her name is Justine Piggott and she is a brilliant writer who has penned many best-selling books. Her first navigated the tragic death of her sister and soulmate Ruth, while others explored the worlds of Coco Chanel and Dior. But I know her best as the ex-editor of Harper's Bazaar. Back in my early 30s, I worked at Red Magazine and Justine used to write a monthly column for us. And at the time, she was going through a devastating marriage split. And I remember that I could almost feel the pain and the anguish leaping off the page. As a young mother and happily married, I couldn't imagine I would ever go through such a thing, but I did. And now, two decades later, I'm so grateful for talking to Justine about her heartbreak journey. Thank you so much, Justine, for joining us. I really, really appreciate it. And could I start by asking you, going into as much detail as you'd like to, but how the split happened and how it made you feel in the first instance?
Well, it feels like such a long time ago, and yet, you know, talking about it in some ways, it makes me realize how much I've changed. But anyway, the kind of long and the short of it was that my first husband and I split up about 14 years ago. And we'd had our ups and downs. We'd had two children and it hadn't been an easy relationship. He was and is a musician who was away and toured a lot. But I suppose eventually the catalyst was that he fell in love with somebody else. And looking back on it now with sort of time does heal, I think that probably people in a relationship, one person doesn't fall in love with somebody else if the relationship is working. But at the time, the way I felt was it was all because he'd fallen in love with somebody else, if that makes sense.
Yes, that totally makes sense. And I think I remember talking to counselors and they would say exactly what you say, but in the moment when you're only just discovering that, it's so hard to process, isn't it? And I think, I remember one counsellor saying, you know, the other person is like a sort of rowboat out of a situation for lots of people. So for you, was it a total shock?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, of course one knows on some level, yet there was a shock at the sense that it really was over, that our marriage really was over. And I think that in retrospect, although it was felt very savage and very hard to deal with, because my then husband was so clear that, you know, our marriage was over, that clarity gave me the opportunity to not kind of hope that we were going to get back together again, which I think I would have done in other circumstances, and to realise that, I had to accept the situation for what it was.
And gosh, I mean, that must have been so painful, that sort of the rejection. I mean, how did you deal with that in the sort of, you know, right in the eye of the storm? I mean, who did you get to help you? Did you reach out to family or did you read a lot? Or I read that you went on a trip as well afterwards, kind of a healing trip.
Yes, that's right. So, I was fortunate in that I was already in therapy. I already was just speaking to a therapist every week. And that's, I'd started going to therapy after the death of my sister, Ruth, who died of breast cancer when she was just 33. And And so having already been going to therapy, it really helped that I was already in that therapeutic, you know, sort of setting to deal with the end of my marriage. And I think that also having gone through the death of my sister and the terrible sort of savage grief and bereavement, that I was better equipped to face the challenge of the end of my marriage, because, you know, the end of a marriage is like a form of bereavement. It's, you grieve for what has been lost. And I knew, having gone through that process with my sister, and it never ends. I mean, you know, my sister died in 1997, which is 25 years ago, this year. But, you know, I still grieve for her. But I also know that my love for her and her love for me is completely part of me and is part of who I am.
Yeah, and I absolutely. And I guess you grieve for the future as you grieve for your future as well, don't you? And I think when a relationship goes as well, it's like it's the sort of crumbling of, you know, the future that you might have together and going to your children's weddings and, you know,
exactly
going to. Yeah. So I think that's a very hard thing to process.
It is, but I also, having gone through the that journey with my sister, I knew that when people say, oh, you'll get over it, as if it's just a sort of little fence you can leap over.
Yeah.
I knew that, you know, there's you don't just kind of get over something. It's a long journey, but I definitely think for the journey about with the end of my marriage, I was better equipped. I already had a map and a compass, having gone through the challenge of losing my sister, of her death. And then, yes, you're right, in terms of undertaking a physical journey, I was in the midst of researching a biography of Coco Chanel when this happened. And I had already arranged to go to the place where Chanel had been abandoned as a child after her mother's death by her father, which was an orphanage in Aubusine, in a Catholic convent, which was part of a medieval abbey in very remote part of rural France, sort of south central France in the mountains. And I nearly didn't go because I was in a state of crisis. I felt that I, you know, shouldn't leave my children at that point and do the journey. But I spoke to two very good friends who said, you know, you've got to go, and it's an important part of the research for your book. And no writer had ever sort of been given access to the abbey and to the convent. So, and good friends of mine had said that, you know, we'd already arranged that she was going to stay in the house and look after the boys, you know, and our cat and our dog. And she said, you must go. Anyway, I missed the first Eurostar that I was supposed to be on because of just being in a terrible state. And I remember I arrived at St. Pancras and kind of queued up, and the ticket I had was not one that could just simply be changed, but I was standing in the queue, and then I got to the front of the queue, and the guy on the ticket booth said, you know, why have you missed your train? And I said, because my husband's left me. And
oh God, I remember those times. You're just so raw, aren't you?
And
I just felt so untethered. I remember,
you know. Anyway, he very sweetly issued me a new Eurostar ticket without charging, you know, me for a new one. And I got on the train to Paris, and then I stayed the night with a friend, and then I got up at dawn to get on the train to get to this very distant part of France. And then I arrived there, and it was the beginning of March. It was really cold. You know, it was freezing, stone medieval building, and I was sleeping in this tiny little kind of iron bed with a crucifix above it. And I spent a lot of time crying. But I also, the nuns had said that I could go and do this research, but I had to sort of follow their daily routine, which meant getting up when they did and going to prayers and having meals when they did. And it helped, not in the, you know, I didn't sort of find the Catholic God that they believed in, but I certainly felt that being there, that, you know, many people have suffered many challenges, not least Gabrielle Chanel at the age of 11, having lost her mother and being abandoned by her father. And so I really did become viscerally absorbed in this sense of what it must have been like to have been abandoned at the age of 11 in this very remote, punishing place. But there was also beauty in this place. I went for a long walk up through the chestnut woods in the hills beyond the abbey, and the there was a very austere beauty in the abbey, and there was just a moment when I sort of caught the light shining through this abstract stained glass windows, and I looked at them and I could suddenly see the origins of the double C for Coco Chanel. But also I felt that beam of light, and that somehow strength and resilience are incredibly important things that we have to find within ourselves, and that that is part of everybody's journey. You have to find that inner strength, that inner resilience, and pick yourself up. Now, nobody can teach you how to do that. There can be people that can help, but ultimately at a certain point you have to find those resources. And yes, friends were incredibly important. Researching and writing my book about Coco Chanel was very important. Therapy was very important. My children, my sons were very important. But ultimately, you know, it just takes as long as it takes.
Nobody, you don't want to hear that, do you? In fact, I get messaged from so many women saying, how long does it take? And it's just so hard because it's different for everybody. But
it's
I do think the steps that you're talking about do make a difference. And I just wondered, one of the things that I was very afraid of in the beginning was being by myself and really facing my feelings. And it sounds like actually that trip, you know, I don't know if they were silent, the nuns, or if, I mean, you,
well, they
obviously
were mostly,
you did
silent. Were mostly silent. They were, and they spoke just at meal times and then very seldom. The rest of the time they were silent. So I was really there with my feelings. But I think that I was able to put those feelings into a wider context of, you know, love and loss are the two archetypal emotions that make us human, that, you know, they are inextricably linked, love and loss. Unless you've loved, you won't know loss. And
yes, you wrote something very beautiful that I read this morning about sort of, you know, exactly that. And then actually the sort of cracks becoming that, you know, the chinks through which the light come through.
Exactly. It's through the cracks that the light comes in. And all of us, if we didn't know what those cracks feel like, you know, we wouldn't know the miracle of the light. If you haven't known the darkness, those dark, dark hours of the night when it feels like you're the only person who's awake in the darkness. But unless you've known those dark nights, you don't appreciate the miracle of the dawn. And when you're going through the darkness, it's so hard, it's so challenging, but it's part of what makes us strong and makes us human.
I totally agree. And I wonder if you had the same experience as me, is that sometimes there were people who I didn't know particularly well, or they were friends of friends, but they'd had a very similar experience. And so they reached out, and that was kind of, that was amazing. And that's kind of like why I think hope this podcast is so useful to people, because I think if you've been through it and somebody's, you know, somebody else has been through it and they've suffered the same thing and they've survived, it does give you hope, doesn't it?
It really gives you hope. And I remember one of the, I had two friends who gave me very different, as it were, pieces of advice, both of which in retrospect were incredibly helpful, but one of which was very hard to hear at the time. So the one that was very hard, but ultimately good, was an old friend of mine who'd also known my ex-husband. And she said to me, and she'd been through a divorce, and she said to me, he just didn't love you enough. And then she said it again. He didn't love you enough. He didn't love you enough. She said it three times. And God, it was hard to hear, but it was true. You know, if somebody really loves you, they don't fall in love with somebody else. And I found it hard, but that was important. And then the other thing that felt very meaningful to me at the time was, again, somebody who'd been through the end of a long relationship and a very good friend. And she said to me, it feels like the end of everything. It feels like the end of the story. But she said, it's not. It's the end of a chapter. And there will be many more chapters in your story. This is the end of one chapter. And indeed, not just one, I mean, a number of chapters. And again, in retrospect, because I think that where it's similar to a bereavement is that when somebody dies, for a long time, it's hard to remember anything other than the horror of their final months and their death. Mm. So thinking about my sister, for a long time, all I could think about was how terrible it was, her having terminal breast cancer and then her death. Mm. I couldn't remember what had been so good and wonderful and life enhancing and joyful about our lives together as sisters before she got sick. And then slowly I remembered who she was before she got sick and all the happiness that we had shared together. And the many episodes, the happy episodes we'd shared. And I think that it's not the same with a divorce, but I do think that after, it took time, but that I grew to realize that there were, you know, many good and happy chapters in the story of my relationship with the father of my children. The greatest gift that he gave to me was two sons who, you know, I adore, who I can't imagine my life without those two wonderful boys, and they're now, you know, men in them. And those are the wonderful things that emerged out of my first marriage, the wonderful people that emerged. And ultimately, and somebody else said this to me, you know, you have to let go of the sense of, you know, rage or disappointment or betrayal or humiliation or jealousy, all those very, and that's an easy thing to say. And I remember thinking, well, it's all very well saying that, but it's very hard to do. But again, it's really important to let go, because what is more important is the sons that we had together, that they, you know, eclipse the negative emotions. And the very important advice that this third person gave to me was, you have to let go of that, because what is more important is that you have your sons. And once you can let go of the rage and the bitterness and the grief, then your next episode, your next adventure will unfold. Because whatever it is, you know, whether it's writing another book or, you know, something else, some other adventure, perhaps falling in love again. It's not going to happen if you're so filled with bitterness or rage. And
absolutely,
that was excellent advice.
That expression that says resentment is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. You know, it's that kind of, actually you're so busy being kind of resentful and angry at your ex-partner, but actually, you know, it's the only person it's damaging is you, really, in that.
And it's really poisoning. It's very poisoning. And I also think what's very, very important is that, you know, for people going through a divorce, it's really important that, you know, the therapy that you need and help comes through the therapy, and that the divorce doesn't become a way of expressing those emotions of whatever they are, you know, grief or rage or jealousy, because lawyers' fees are much more expensive. If the divorce becomes the arena through which you're trying to deal with those emotions, it's a very, you know, it's a very bad and damaging and expensive way to do it. So
that's
my ex and I managed
advice.
To have a very, you know, kind of cordial divorce, which was incredibly important.
Yeah, no, that's really impressive. And in terms of your I know now that you're, you know, you happily married, and that's such a lovely thing to think about, but did you have a period of time by yourself? Did you think it was very important to do that, or did you actually sort of want to jump into another relationship? And, you know, there's different schools of thought about that, I think.
I think there's really no sort of right way or wrong way. I think that although it seemed as if the my husband falling in love with some first husband falling in love with somebody else was the end, in fact, as I said earlier, you know, a relationship is already ending, and there are other ways that it's coming to an end for somebody within the relationship to have an affair. And I had. And partly because of his work, you know, he was away a lot. So I'd spent a lot of time by myself anyway in that relationship. And yes, I couldn't imagine getting involved with anybody else for a while. I thought, you know, I've got my friends, I've got this book to write. I've got my sons. I don't need a man in my life. And I also didn't want to risk being hurt again. And then, much to my surprise, I went to I did feel it was kind of important to leave, to allow the space in my life, you know, for new encounters. And that might have involved meeting new friends. And I think it's quite good, as you said, to sort of spend time with people who've been through something similar. So you don't want to just spend all your time with people that are in happy marriages. Yeah. It's quite good to, you know, spend time with people who are single as well.
Yeah, anyway, and there is that whole period of exhilaration as well, isn't
exactly.
there, when you're kind of,
you're doing things you wouldn't have necessarily done before. But I did go to a dinner party that I nearly didn't go to because it was a sort of school night. And anyway, I went and I did meet somebody, and I was clearly being set up with the guy on my right, and the man on my left was clearly being set up with the woman on his left. So we were both being set up with other people. But in fact, we ended up talking to each other a lot. And I've written about him, so I sort of feel, you know, I'm happy to talk about him. But he was very, very different to me, and very, very different to my first husband. So I fell in love with my first husband. You know, I met him when I was still at university. He was a musician, kind of bohemian, you know, left wing. We came from a kind of similar backgrounds, both grew up in London with kind of, you know, left wing Marxist parents. And and I remember at university, and then in my 20s, you know, those kind of guys were the only people I could ever imagine being with. But then, you know, what you, and some people are very lucky and meet a soulmate, you know, in their very, very young. And I'm not saying that my ex-husband, you know, I could never wish away our relationship now because we had our children together. But anyway, the man that I met in my 40s, Philip, he had been to Eton and Oxford. He's was a barrister, you know, sort of member of the English upper classes, you could say, the sort of establishment, for want of a better word. And you know, I'd been a punk as a teenager, and we, on the surface of it, might have seemed very, very different. But I think that I'd learned to be more open-minded. I mean, certainly if you don't have that sort of wisdom in your 40s, that compared to one's 21-year-old self, then you probably haven't evolved very much. But yes, I did. I think that having done a lot of work in therapy, and, you know, spending, just growing up, and just perhaps having more wisdom in my 40s, I realized that being with somebody that really loved me for who I am, and I really fell in love with him for exactly who he is. And at no point did I ever think, oh, this will all be fine if, you know, he did this, or if I could persuade him to love me more. It just was so solid. And I think that I'd spent time when I was younger, and this, my parents were divorced and had, you know, I had pretty kind of turbulent and dysfunctional childhood. I mean, maybe doesn't everybody, but, you know, I didn't come from a sort of straightforward upbringing. And I think that I didn't have a good relationship with my own father as a child. And so I think, without wanting this to sound like kind of psychobabble, I didn't know, you know, how to choose somebody that truly loved me for who I was.
No, that sounds incredible. I mean, I do think that is the gift of divorce almost, isn't it? It makes you so self-aware, and maybe makes you really think about what you need rather than just who you fancy in a t-shirt.
Exactly. And it's really important. And I remember, as you know, sometimes I heard it as a young woman, where, you know, sort of older women, mentors, would say, you know, the best career advice I can give you is to fall in love with the right person, somebody that will truly support you and, you know, be proud of you, and so that you're not sort of, your head isn't filled with trying to fix a relationship.
And it's, yeah, I totally, it's really good advice. That. I remember just thinking, I can't do it unless I've sort of got that strength behind me. I mean, the irony is, and I don't know whether it's for you, I did have that strength through a lot of years and felt totally secure. And actually, in a way, though, once it had gone and you're sort of living this life, which is, you know, you feeling all the feels, as they say, you know, actually, in terms of my writing, I think it gave me something. It gave me a sort of edge, you know, that I'd sort of lost. Did you feel that in that at all?
Definitely. I mean, I wrote my first book after my sister died, If the Spirit Moves You, and it's about the experience of love and loss and the relationship between the living and the dead, really, which is love. And I think that tremendous challenge, it wasn't that I was writing as therapy, I was having therapy as therapy, but I think that nevertheless the experience did make me a different kind of writer, because up until then I'd done journalism, this first book emerged, it was like the truest part of myself, my truest voice was emerging. And I think that writing my biography of Coco Chanel, I think going through the process of abandonment and finding inner resilience and strength, which is what Chanel did in her life. Yeah. I think it's a better book because I had more understanding of what it meant in Chanel's life to try and be an independent woman at a time where women didn't even have the vote. So, yes, I mean, and I think that, I mean, I have a good relationship with my ex-husband now, and it's taken, it took a long time, but, you know, we have spent Christmases together, you know, with, and when our oldest son got married, we were all there together, both me and my husband and my ex-husband and his wife. And it felt, I can't believe, you know, there was a time when I couldn't have imagined saying this, but it feels good. You know, it feels that there's a lot of healing that has happened. And we've become grandparents for the first time. My oldest son and my daughter-in-law had their first baby just before Christmas. And, you know, we all spent Christmas together. And there's something very moving, you know, about
I mean, I think lots of people out there will think, you can recover. Oh, what a brilliant, well, that's just amazing. Thank you. I feel like that might be a really good place to finish on. But I think I wondered if you could just, if there would just be a few sentences you might be able to say to yourself, like, you know, when you're in the worst pits. I mean, I guess you've kind of said it, but, you know, how to say to someone how they will get through those first really early days.
It's that to acknowledge it is terrible. You know, it is savage. It's like being in the grip of in the jaws of a savage beast. And you think, when every second is painful, you think, how am I going to get through the next minute, you know, let alone the next week? But you will get through it and you will become stronger. And you'll probably, almost certainly, once you've gone through the pain and the suffering, you will be a stronger person, and then you will become happier, because that terrible unhappiness that accompanies the end of a relationship, the seeds of that unhappiness were already in the relationship, because happy marriages, things bring them to an end, like death, but the love still survives the death. But a really strong relationship, people are unlikely, you know, to end it or fall in love with somebody else. And so by going through that grief, that pain, that suffering, that darkness, the jealousy, the humiliation, all those horrible, poisonous feelings, ultimately you will get through it. And then, having gone through all of it, you have your new opportunity to be happy. And that's what also comes with age. I mean, I have just turned 60 and I've just become a grandmother, two very important things. And I am happier, so much happier now than I was in my 20s, in my 30s. You know, there is a reason that when you look at reported levels of happiness amongst people all around the world, it's very often women in their 60s, because we've been through all this stuff. You know, we've been through all this pain. And then you realize those moments of joy, those moments of pleasure, those moments of happiness string together like pearls on a string of pearls and make a contented life. And you will get there, I promise you.
Oh, Justin, thank you. That is amazing. Thank you. I'm sure anybody listening to this will give them so much hope and comfort and inspiration. So I am truly, truly grateful to talk to you. And I really appreciate you carving time out and for going back there, because sometimes it's things we'd rather not remember. So thank you.
Thank you. And good luck to everybody who's listening.
Thank you. Bye, Justine.
Bye. Bye.
You have been listening to Life's Rosie, a Viral Tribe production. I'd be so grateful if you could like and subscribe wherever you currently listen to your podcast. To find out more about what Viral Tribe are up to, go to tribe.fm. That's tribe with two I's.fm. Sign up and join the podcast revolution. Thanks for listening.